This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome to The People Speak. I'm your host, Malik Johnson, and we are joined today with the National Executive Director of Pacifica Radio Foundation, Mr. Greg Guma. Mr. Guma is a self-described practical idealist and anarcho-Buddhist and an author of many articles, screenplays, and books such as The Spirits of Desire. And he co-authored Passport to Freedom, a guide for world citizens, with Gary Davis. Mr. Guma won a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship for his writing on civil liberties and the First Amendment, which is, of course, is dear to me, in 1980. And he co-founded and edited the Vermont Guardian. Mr. Greg Guma, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
If you don't mind, I'd like to call you Greg. May I please?
I don't mind at all. I prefer it, in fact.
Thank you. You know, many listeners may not be familiar with Pacifica Radio, in that Pacifica was the first public radio network in the United States and was founded by a World War II conscientious objector, Mr. Lewis Hill, in 1946. I was wondering, could you share a little bit more with our listeners about Pacifica Radio and why and how you became the National Executive Director in January 2006?
Sure. Well, as you say, Pacifica, in a sense, predates the rest of public radio. It really invented the idea of listener-supported radio. And it's called Pacifica because Lew Hill and others who were involved in the initial formation of it were pacifists and were trying to start a radio station that would speak about war and peace issues. The first station that was founded by this group of people was KPFA, which remains the flagship station, which is located in Berkeley, California. That happened in 1949 after the war. And subsequently, over the years, other stations joined the Pacifica network, WBAI in New York, which became very well known in the 60s for its work on the war in Vietnam and a lot of social justice issues. WPFW in Washington, D.C., one of the leading jazz stations in that city. KPFT in Houston, which joined the network later and was actually bombed twice in 1970s at the time it first went on the air by the Klan. And KPFK in Los Angeles. And they form the core of the Pacifica network today. In addition, Pacifica has more than 120 affiliate stations. Those are stations that have various kinds of contractual relationships with the network for the receipt of programming, programming like Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin, which the network launched about 11 years ago as an election year show. We have daily newscasts, both locally generated on the station and also through Free Speech Radio News, a half-hour daily newscast. We have a half-hour newscast in Spanish on a daily basis. And we do a lot of special national programmings when hearings occur. And, for example, right now, today, as I'm talking to you, we're finishing up our 4 days of coverage of the U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta. So the Pacifica Network is really unique in America in that it is really the core of democratic media on radio. And I say that not only because it promotes the kind of programming that foster democracy, but that its structure itself is also an expression of that. We have elected boards of directors at the five Pacifica stations and create the national board out of those elections. And so rather than money talking, it's political principles that talk.
with the political principles equals high energy environment. Now, you took the position in 2006 where there was a lot of, political high energy. I should say that.
Well, that's true, although I think that the time that what people most remember as being controversial predates my arrival. Just to give you background on myself, I've been a journalist and a political activist and also a manager of both media and social justice organizations dating back to the late 1960s, so I'm no spring chicken. I've worked primarily in print media, although I have done a lot of radio and film work as well. And so I came to this knowing full well that it was a difficult job, some people say undoable job. What happened at Pacifica was about a decade ago, there was an attempt by some of the people who were running the network at that time to change the direction of the network. Some called it mainstream, others of a more critical mind called it a hijacking. But the result was that there were tremendous protests throughout the late 1990s, which culminated at the turn of the millennium and into 2001. People may recall the actual street protests or people being thrown off the air. But that was all resolved in 2001 and 2002, and a new set of bylaws were put in place at that time. It's about 5 years ago now. And the last 5 years has been the work of really rebuilding the organization after that tumultuous change. And so, yes, there are still disputes. There are disputes between people who might want to have a more decentralized organization where a lot of the control would be at the local level and local programming, and people who believe that there should be more of a national identity for the network. Differences about what goes on the air, who goes on the air, what are our values, what is our mission in the 21st century, how are we going to respond to the changes in the media environment. But this is all occurring in a democratic context, and as one of the board members often reminds me, you know, democracy is messy, and so we're doing it perhaps in a somewhat messier way, but also in a more transparent way, and hopefully the results will, in the long run, be for the benefit of our millions of listeners across the country.
In fact, in November 2001, with the interim board that you mentioned, the bylaws,
yes.
That's when the listeners got the right and have a responsibility to elect new local boards at each of the five.
That's correct, yes.
The new
structure that was put in place calls for, at this moment, elections 2 out of every 3 years at the 5 stations that I mentioned, and so they elect about 24 people on a staggered basis, and they in turn have their own elections to elect people to the national board. We're currently looking at the bylaws to see whether we can make some improvements on that. Bylaws amendments that would perhaps create a bit more continuity in the long term. But this change is unique in radio, and for those who are interested in the media democracy movement, they really should look at how things are going at Pacifica, because this organization is really playing out what a lot of media democracy movement activists would like to see happen in other media. So both our mistakes and our accomplishments should be examined, I think.
And before you actually even took the job, I realized that Pacifica had a tumultuous history internally, and there was political issues there, programming ideas, governance, financial situation, organizational structure. And before you even took the position, or were first day on the job, I should say, people were basically trying to characterize you. Some had called you a demanding would-be overseer, a conspiracy person. They said you were naive before you even actually were on the job, before you made the first decision on your job. Now, what do they think now? You've turned this organization. It is financially sound. You've started new programs such as From the Vault, which I love. You have the, I believe it's Informativo Pacifica. That's the Spanish language newscast. And also you have Informed Dissent. What is the praise now? What is the view of you now by many of these people?
Well,
initially,
Yes, I hear you. Sorry for the delay. Well, first of all, I can't take credit for all of those things. I mean, From the Vault is a program that was developed by the Pacifica Radio Archives and its director, Brian DeShazer. Informativo Pacifica is a program developed by KPFK and its co-news director Fernando Velasquez. And so, you know, Pacifica operates by pulling on the resources of people from throughout the country. And as you say, when I came, people had a lot of impressions about me because I was coming from outside the organization. I think they would have had impressions about me even if I was an insider. But I was a person who did not have a history with Pacifica, so there was an attempt to try to figure out who I was. And the Internet, which is a great thing, also results in a lot of rumors being circulated from time to time. And so if you write an article, for example, as I did, saying that I think there are a lot of unanswered questions about 9/11, people will then potentially interpret that to mean that you are a conspiracy theorist, which is not what I am, although I think there are certainly some conspiracies that should be examined. I think over the last year and a half, we have made some progress, particularly in the area of national programming. As I say, this is a decentralized organization, and so we can't compel people to cooperate. But I think that the there is more collaboration over the past year. Excuse me. And we have
like
also had a good year or two financially. But I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, radio is changing dramatically, and we are beginning to see a shift in listeners from traditional terrestrial radio to other platforms, particularly the Internet and people receiving things through iPods and the coming of HD radio. And so we're in the process of trying to adapt to that. And also we are dependent to a large extent on our listeners. About 85% of the total money that Pacifica raises comes from individual listeners. And so that means we have to respond to changes. Our listeners are aging. We have to attract new and younger listeners. And so I wouldn't say that all the problems are solved, but I think perhaps the some of the distrust that existed still at the time that I took the job may be reduced. And so I would say modest changes, modest improvements, but the result of the efforts of hundreds of people.
I'd like to say From the Vault in particular, that's the nation's oldest public radio archive. You all have.
That's correct, and I should have mentioned that before. Yeah, the Pacifica Archive is really unique, and people really don't recognize the extent to which radio has existed for obviously for a long time, but most of it comes and goes. Pacifica made the decision to retain those tapes for decades. The problem is now we have thousands and thousands of tapes, which are in reel-to-reel form and other formats, and they now have to be digitized. They have to be preserved. We have an enormous vault. It's not From the Vault is called that because there is, in fact, an enormous room, a vault, which is filled with rows and rows of these tapes, some of which have been examined in detail, but every week people are bringing new material to light. And so what From the Vault does is it tries to take particular points in time. For example, a couple of weeks ago they looked at a demonstration which had occurred in Los Angeles in June of 1967, the Century City Plaza protest, and found a lot of actuality tape from that protest, and so put it together into a half hour long show, or the San Diego Folk Music Festival, or interviews with people over the years that Pacifica stations have done. And so that show is available to our stations, to the affiliates, and anyone else who wants it. I understand it's even going to be broadcast in the UK starting this fall on one of the BBC channels. And so it really has a unique place. And next year we're going to be bringing forward a lot of programming from 1968, a really spectacular year in the history of the United States. And so we will be making a special effort to bring forward a lot of the programming that was done during that year on a variety of Pacifica stations, and packaging it not only through From the Vault but in other programming throughout 68. So you'll be hearing a lot of things that you might remember, some of you, from your younger days.
Well, 1968, I think, is slightly before my time. But I was really interested in From the Vault. You have recorded priceless things, You have priceless interviews from John Coltrane, James Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, Langston Hughes. I said, you know, if you all really wanted to just, you know, relieve yourself of those interviews, you can always send them to us.
Yeah, well, I mean, you will certainly be able to get access to them, and actually more people will be able to get access to them if we succeed in reorienting ourselves to these new digital platforms. We're trying to establish a new licensing regime within Pacifica that will allow a broader distribution of this kind of material, an archive of material that would be available to individual Internet users rather than only to stations. I'll give you an example. And, you know, Pacifica actually trained volunteers to travel to the South for coverage of the civil rights movement in the early 60s. And we, you know, we covered those demonstrations and those activities down there. So we have not only interviews and music and, you know, Alan Watts and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and all those great, you know, beat poets, but also the anti-war movement, the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, the, in a sense, the history of the social justice struggles in this country for the last 58 years are kept in that archive, and we're preserving them at considerable expense, I would say, and bringing them out to a new generation of people.
And you know, many would love to get their hands on those. You were mentioning about radio, and you were talking about the new technologies. In fact, I want to ask that particular question as far as the, you know, people receiving radio in different ways today. You have the satellite, you have the internet radio, iPod. You have so many technologies today. How is Pacifica Radio Foundation responding to these new communications?
Well, what we've begun to do already is at some of the stations, if you go to the websites, of the each of the stations has its own website. You can listen to, you know, the radio stations anywhere in the world, really, through streaming capacity. But also we're creating podcasts of certain programs that we have clear title to. But what we want to do going further than that is we want to make arrangements with the hundreds of programmers that we have on the air so that we can basically license their work from them so that we can then package it and make it available for free to the general public. As it stands right now, we have contractual relationships which allow us to distribute those programs to individual radio stations, but not to individuals. So what we have to do is make a new kind of arrangement with the volunteer programmers, the unpaid staff members who really do a lot of the work, so that they will feel protected, but at the same time, a much larger audience will be able to get their shows. I think also over time, we're going to have to rethink what kind of programs we put on the air. The long-form program that used to be very popular may not be the thing that, you know, younger listeners want to listen to. So we're going to have to get a little smarter in the way we package programs as well, in segments, so that people can get their 10 or 20-minute segment that they want. If you look at the Pacifica website, we're already beginning to do this. If you go to the main website at pacifica.org, you'll see categories of programs and segments of those programs identified. And so you can basically go and listen to and potentially download a particular interview or a particular news article on the air. So we're going to be doing much more of that. We're also going to be working on establishing clear rights you know, to that material so that we can make it available to people through a what's called a Creative Commons licensing structure, which basically protects the originator of the work for non-commercial distribution. But if there are some subsequent commercial distribution where money is involved, then the person who created the show would share in any of the income from that. That's the sort of the difficult part that's being worked out, and we've been working with lawyers from Creative Commons and our own attorneys, as well as programs throughout the country, to work out the details of that.
Exactly. You're trying to empower.
Excuse me?
There's a delay there.
Go ahead.
Welcome to People Speak. We were having momentarily technical difficulties. We are here with Mr. Greg Gouma, who is the National Executive Director of Pacifica Radio Foundation. I apologize deeply, Greg, for this. I love speaking with you, and I thought the interview was so excellent. So we'd like to pick up from where we left off.
No problem. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate this. You were talking about what you all are planning to do as far as the new technologies are concerned, the radios, such as the satellite radio, internet radio, and you were talking about the website. And I am at your website. I'm perusing, and you're absolutely correct. Of course, you would be about the website as far as there's many topics we can click on. Can we listen to some of the shows via the internet?
Yes, you can listen to some of them. You see, the issue is that we have the rights to the programs that are produced by our staff. We have a staff of between 200 and 300 people at the various stations around the country. The issue is that we also air programs by many, many hundreds of volunteer programmers, unpaid staff people. And what we're working out now is a new licensing arrangement with those folks so that we will also be able to distribute much more widely their programming on a non-commercial basis. And so the license would allow us to then have available to the general public rather than just to stations, segments and whole programs from across the country. And then you'd be able to download those into your iPod or whatever device into your computer. And so what we're hoping is that within the next few months we will work out the both the legal and the technical issues, and so there will be even more programming available starting in the fall. And what we're trying to do also is to retool the stations, moving further into this digital age, so that the stations can really be audio resource and training centers where people can come and learn the skills of radio, get programs on the air either on terrestrial radio or on one of our streams. And then you'll be able to hear much more radio than you can now. And also HD high-definition radio is coming on, and several of the stations are tooling up for that as well. And what that means basically is if you have an HD receiver, which will be available in cars fairly soon, and also in some cities already it's being used, that we'll be able to actually have three radio channels where there was only one in the past, and that will make much more programming available. So, I mean, there are some legal issues to be resolved, but we are working through them. And, Pacifica, is unlike commercial radio, is we have a lot of staff and a lot of programmers, and we have to really listen to what all of them have to say about how they want to be treated in this new approach to radio. So, you can visit the websites of the individual stations now. There are some podcasts you can already get, and I'd say within a matter of months they'll be much more available.
And as far as the organization as a whole, what are you hoping further to accomplish?
Well, I mean, one of the issues that's being worked on, I mentioned earlier, is the relationship between the local stations and the national organization. I'm the executive director of the Pacifica Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation, but the stations really kind of operate individually. We hold the licenses, but they make their own decisions about programming. And so one of the things that's being worked on right now is what is the nature of that relationship? To what extent does national programming get distributed on the various stations? For example, when we see an important event occur, it might be an impeachment hearing, for example, or some other key event. We want to be able to broadcast it across the country. Right now, we haven't really worked out the arrangements for that. Each of the stations is operating in a different culture, and they have different procedures in place for preempting programming. And so we're resolving those issues so that Pacifica can project messages to the entire country. We did, as you mentioned, Informed Dissent, which was a short-term series last fall for the congressional elections. What we want to do now is we want to launch another show sometime in the near future, in a sense as a bookend to Democracy Now!, which is already broadcast throughout our network and beyond our network, another daily program that would be available to all the stations and to the affiliate stations. But in order to work that out, we have to satisfy the concerns of people at the various local stations, the programmers and the program directors and the general manager and the local boards there. There's a lot of stakeholders and a lot of people to be consulted.
Yes. Well, Greg, let me ask you, how can we as the listeners help you?
Well, certainly you can continue to, you know, as individual listeners, when there's a fund drive, not get too irritated by the incessant pitching for money and make a contribution, participate in the election process that, you know, and that we hold right now every 2 out of every 3 years. And if I can say, not listen to necessarily the rumors that you maybe hear that there's some crisis occurring at Pacifica every week, because that's not really the case. There are people who want to make it seem like the organization is in perpetual crisis, but that's really not the case. We have problems like any organization does. We try to resolve these in an amicable way. So don't get overly upset if you hear that, you know, there's some dispute going on at a local station. These are the problems that any growing organization would have. So just stick with us and try to focus on the programming rather than on the rumors.
Excellent. Greg, I'm curious now. I know about the organization, and listeners know about the organization, but we'd like to know a little bit more about Greg Guma. In fact, you said that you're an anarcho-Buddhist. Now, I understand that anarcho is from anarchism, and I also realize that Buddhism is an Eastern philosophy of suppressing worldly desires, and thereby you should reach a state of enlightenment. What is an anarcho-Buddhist?
Well, first of all, I have not reached a state of enlightenment or even gotten anywhere close to it, but it's kind of a term that I made up for myself when people kept asking me, well, you know, where are you coming from politically? You know, obviously, I've been involved in social justice movements, and I am in favor of decentralized power and wealth in society. I'm very much drawn to the philosophy of anarchism. I know that just like any philosophy or ism, it has its problems in the implementation phase. But what I'm talking about in terms of anarchism is an emphasis on diversity and on reasonable and human scale and on the decentralization of both power and wealth. The Buddhism aspect of it has to do more than with getting rid of all earthly desires. It has to do with tolerance and acceptance. Because I believe that, you know, we have to, all of us are suffering in one way or another, but if we realize that we have much in common, we can get beyond that to a point of tolerance. And I think that one of the things that Pacifica is struggling with is to reconcile differences between people so that we can disagree and still live in harmony. And so, you know, philosophically, you know, I believe in, you know, basically acceptance and, in a sense, a kind of a surrender to the uncertainty that we live with. And in politics, I'm trying to, you know, listen to a lot of different voices rather than imposing things by compelling people from above. Now, that's very difficult in a mature corporate enterprise, and there are times, I have to admit, when I wish I could simply tell people what they should be doing. I think that for Pacifica, this is a much more appropriate approach.
So you don't have a dictatorial, like a totalitarianistic way of managing. You actually help people come to the conclusion that you want them to come to by giving them all the resources they need and the information.
I'm trying to do that. To some extent, there have been, you know, people who feel like they want me to take sides in a dispute to identify myself with one or another interest group or faction, and I've attempted not to do that. I believe in, you know, in being transparent as much as possible with information, in empowering people, in listening as much as talking. And that's what I've tried to do, is to sort of build in structures where people can really work out problems amongst themselves. And we've had some success with that. Pacifica would not be open to a dictatorial type of executive director. That's what they rebelled against. And so if I attempted to impose my own solutions on the organization, they would be resisted, and rightly so.
You also describe yourself as a practical idealist, and this is something that also mystified me and perhaps many others. You know, those two terms, well, ostensibly, they're contradictory. How do you, at minimum, make them complementary?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm an idealist in the sense that I believe that we can build a better society, that we can move to a point beyond the dysfunctional nature of the marketplace and corporate-run democracy we have now. But I don't believe that we can do it through some sort of radical break with the past, just overturn a system. I think even if there in the 60s and 70s, you remember there were people who were arguing for armed struggle in the United States or argue for a very dramatic break with the status quo. I think that that, to some extent, ends up replicating what we're trying to overcome. And so I try to move on a stepwise basis. That's the practical side, to make changes on a day-by-day basis, because I think sometimes people who believe that you have to make this radical break don't trust other people enough to recognize that they can move in on a gradual basis to a better place. So I'm idealistic in terms of my long-term outlook on the world, but I'm practical in terms of the way I choose to approach it. Some might say I'm too pragmatic, or perhaps not hard line enough. But I don't believe that being inflexible is a way to get people to listen to you and to persuade you. I'd rather persuade people than compel people.
Yes, you did a documentary on David Dillinger.
I worked with Dave for about 20-25 years. He lived in Vermont starting in the 70s. That's where I've lived since the 1960s, and I've written about him, and I had the good fortune to really kind of be a student of his on an informal basis. He was also on the chair of the board of directors of the magazine that I edited for a number of years, and so he was mystical in some ways. I think he saw himself to some extent as an anarchist. He was a person who could even convert his opponents through the force of his own will and his willingness to really listen to people, to be forceful and determined, but at the same time to have a kind of a love in his heart that allowed him to even see people he was opposed to during the Vietnam War, to hear what they had to say and to somehow convert them. And I don't think I'm Dave. I think anyone ever will be again, but I do try to take to heart the lessons that he taught me.
Yeah, David Dillinger was probably most famous for Chicago 7, where Bobby Seale and others were a group of protesters who disrupted the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Thank you. For those who don't remember that history, it's an important part of the history of this country.
Absolutely. In fact, it led to charges of conspiracy and crossing state lines with the intention of inciting riot, and that judge there was a very interesting judge. You wrote on May 14th, 2005, switching gears, this was published by the United Press International. There was an article that I believe you entitled it, Media Misses the News. In fact, you stated that there is media that carry water for the Bush administration and its friends.
Duh.
Yeah. I have to ask this, Greg.
I think we all know that that the Bush administration misled the country. I don't think that's going to come as news to anyone. I think that, but I think that the bigger question is the extent to which the mainstream media is in the business of shaping public perceptions, not only on the war in Iraq, but on a broad variety of issues, through a variety of what I like to call perception management techniques, by suppressing certain kinds of information and repeating misinformation in other countries, in other contexts. I'm not saying that there aren't good journalists. There are obviously many great journalists working for large media institutions, but those institutions themselves have very specific agendas, and those agendas have to do with reinforcing the status quo and reinforcing certain assumptions, one of which is that capitalism is the best and only system, that capitalism and democracy are, in a sense, intertwined and identical, that any war that we must enter must be slavishly supported, no matter how wrong its inception has been and how many lies we've been told. We've been lied into Iraq in the same way that we were lied into Vietnam, and that's what I was talking about in that article.
I'm curious about this perception management technique and those in particular media who carry water for the Bush administration. Could you tell us specifically any of those particular media who carry water bearers?
Well, I mean, let me first tell you about, you know, what I mean by this. I mean, I didn't make up this term perception management. Actually, this is a term that is used by the Department of Defense as a term of psychological operations, which is designed to basically form opinion. You know, basically sometimes by telling the truth, sometimes through disinformation. You know, let me give you, you know, a couple of examples. You know, if you look back about 5 years, there was a great groundswell of opposition to corporate globalization, there were meetings of the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund that were being held, and there were tremendous protests being waged. But before each one of those demonstrations, there would be a concerted effort on the part of the media to basically characterize anyone who protested as kind of a crazy person who was trying to mislead people. Basically, they would describe corporate globalization as an attempt to essentially create opportunity, not to create basically a sort of an unequal a system, or reinforce an unequal system where goods and money can flow, but people are forced to exist in untenable financial circumstances. Another example, I mean, when every year when organizations like the National Cancer Institute do their own promotion, basically the media, you'll notice, all the media tend to cover these events at the same time and in the same way, promoting, in a sense, the agenda of the organization, because their reporters are being taken on, on junkets, and then suppressing contrary views or any criticisms. You have television networks like Fox Network, who suppressed information about bovine growth hormone and actually fired the reporters who were trying to tell the truth about it. Television networks who make deals with corporate clients for corporate sponsorship of things like the Olympics, and then suppress, you know, information about the conditions for young children who are working in sweatshop conditions. You have people wearing the Nike swoosh on their logo and not being willing to talk about the problems that Nike and other producers of clothing and sneakers and so forth have across the country. I mean, I don't want to pick on any one news source, but this is a pattern. And the kind of techniques are misplacing the blame on convenient enemies, rationalizing the mistakes that are made, or omitting certain information, confusing rumor with fact, and then refusing to correct the record after the issue is resolved. You never see mistakes admitted, particularly in television, but even in print, even if the mistake is admitted, it'll be in the back page, and, you know, one or two paragraphs. It doesn't undo the damage. And then reporters who work very close to the centers of power, who are protecting relationships with their sources and therefore suppressing information that might undermine that relationship. So you have all these techniques working together to create a false impression, a kind of a false narrative of what's going on in the country. We shouldn't be surprised that, you know, half the people still think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. You know, if that's the kind of media that we have. And Pacifica is an antidote to that. Pacifica is attempting to tell the stories that are being suppressed by this mainstream and corporate media, which is trying to basically open up media and foster independent media, and also foster a dialogue that is not allowed to occur in this kind of hyped up, horse race and very sensationalistic media environment we have today.
In particular, you wrote about 9/11, you questioned it, and I thought that some of the questions that you posed, which was referencing another individual who wrote a book, were absolutely excellent questions, something that I didn't think about until I read what you were what you had wrote. I believe it was David Ray Griffin.
Yeah, David Ray Griffin is one of the number of people who have written about 9/11, and this is controversial, and I can't say that it isn't controversial on Pacifica. There are some people who feel that this is irresponsible conspiracy theorizing, and other people who feel these are legitimate questions. But Griffin and others have questioned whether the whether the planes hit the buildings and that kind of thing, but that what actually occurred in New York was this, for example, a matter of buildings collapsing, or whether there was a planned demolition that occurred and was set in motion by the planes hitting the buildings. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that those buildings may have been brought down by something other than the airplanes. We simply want to get to the truth of the matter. Building 7, which was across the street, there is very strong evidence that that building was not very well, very much damaged, and yet it also collapsed. And there is strong evidence that there might have been an intentional demolition that occurred. The bigger picture, however, is what the role, if any, of the current administration was. And I think the point that I'm making in the article is that we really don't know the extent to which warnings were given. And the conservative who took over the country in 2000 had been waiting for an event like this to occur. They had written about the idea of a new Pearl Harbor that would create the pretext for the types of draconian attacks on democratic values and institutions that's occurred over the last 6 to 7 years. I don't know, and I don't know that anyone, you know, except those who might have been involved, know who knew what and when. But we do know one thing, that a lot more was known before 9/11 than has been revealed to us, just as a lot more is known about some of the other political assassinations, and even about the beginning of World War II, than has been revealed, you know, to date. And so the question is, when are we going to have the thoroughgoing kind of investigation of these matters that is, you know, that we expect in a democracy? That's what I'm saying. Let's ask those questions. We know the administration lied about some things, about Iraq, about weapons of mass destruction, about aluminum tubes, about mushroom clouds. Well, what else did they lie about?
Yeah, and Greg, you know, we thought that the 9/11 Commission was, in fact, going to get or give a thorough investigation into this matter. Do you find it rather odd that the 9/11 Commission omitted Building 7 from its report totally?
Well, obviously, that's one of the things that I reference in the article, that they don't talk about that at all. You know, like the Warren Commission and a number of others, other sort of investigative groups that have been formed and at times of national catastrophe, these are political institutions, and they're managed by, you know, political bureaucrats and others who have interests to protect. And so I don't know that it's surprising that the first draft of history is often rather inaccurate. I think that we will have to wait many years to find the full story, if we really do. But I think what's clear is that there were certain people who benefited from this. The conservatives who wanted for many years to unravel various parts of the Constitution certainly benefited, and we are paying the price for that. It is tragic that thousands of people died and were then, and their deaths have been manipulated to some extent by those who would use a tragedy to advance a narrow political agenda.
Well, well said. Very well said. Greg, if you don't mind, there are a couple of people who, I know many callers actually, but in particular, I wanted to have them, give them the opportunity to actually speak with you.
I'd love to.
Is that fine with you?
Yes.
Thanks a lot. There's a Ken from Ontario, Canada, who wants to ask you a question. Ken, please ask Mr. Greg Gouma a question. Apparently, Ken is not there. But I do know that Greg, that Ken, are you there? Perhaps he's not there. But I know his question was, he wanted to ask, when are you going to release or show the interviews pertaining to John Coltrane?
I can't answer that question. I wish I could, but I'll ask the director of the archives about it. You know, that's a long project.
The interviews with John Coltrane, the very amazing jazz performer. And I was wondering,
I can't hear it, but maybe you can interpret.
There might be a selling of the interviews if something like that, or would there be something for the public?
We're not
to,
able to hear you,
take part in.
I do apologize, Ken. We're not able to hear you.
I think he was asking about whether some of those interviews can be sold, and yeah, the issue is this: we have thousands of hours and thousands of tapes. And what we do is every year we go through as many of them as we can within financial limits, and we do put them on the air, but we also do package them as CDs and do make them available, particularly during our fund drives, as premiums during the fund drive. And so you can buy some of these tapes, and if you visit Pacifica Archives, this is a website, Pacifica Radio Archives, you can sort of see a list of a lot of the programs that are already available, and you can also ask them to get the Coltrane tapes going.
Oh, we can actually make that request?
Sure. You can, you know, and then that'll alert them that there's a demand out there. I mean, I don't know when it will happen, but if the tape is there, I'm sure they can find it, and it's a question of digitizing it and then formatting it for some sort of broadcast.
Absolutely. Excellent. We have another caller, Mike from California. Mike from California, please ask your question to Mr. Guma.
I'm not hearing Mike. Not hearing.
Thank you very much. I think there's a bit of a lag there in the connection. Yes, Greg, thank you for coming on the show. I wanted to know, where do you want to see Pacifica go within the next, in the future under your directorship? Or do you have any really control over that? Are they pretty much loose cannons and the sister stations do what they want? Or are there limitations on what they can do? For example, if they're very much into having President Bush impeached, can they run impeachment PSAs on their network? Thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this person actually knows a bit about Pacifica. I can't say that they're loose cannons. We are a coordinated network, but as I say, a lot of the authority over what goes out over the air does rest with the local station management. And we do have discussions on a regular basis as to what we're going to put on national programming. And we've begun to discuss how to address the impeachment issue, but we haven't come to a network-level decision as we did on a number of other issues. For example, we have been doing a lot of coverage of the attacks on habeas corpus and constitutional rights. We've been covering the Gonzalez hearings. We've been involved in the issue of net neutrality to protect access to information on the Internet. And so we have a set of priorities, the death penalty, and a number of issues where the board or the managers have taken a position. And so it's possible that that might occur. But, you know, in the end, Pacifica is a news and media organization. It's not a political movement. And so the movement for impeachment really, in the end, has to come from the people, not from the media. It would be, you know, a mistake, I think, to some extent, to try to turn a media institution into a political party or a political activist organization. I think our job is basically to carry the message as it rises from the grassroots. So, and you'll find support as the support for impeachment grows. You will find Pacifica stations individually and us collectively getting involved in covering that issue, and perhaps banging the drum a little bit. But we want to see that come from the people.
Thank you, caller. Dennis from Florida, please come and ask your question.
Hello?
Yes, Dennis, we call her, we hear you. Your question for Mr. Gomez? Well, we'll move on to the next caller. Next caller, wherever I believe, please come and ask your question of Mr. Guma.
You promised to call me Greg.
Apparently we're having some delays there. Greg, I don't know. I have many questions to ask if they don't ask.
Well, why don't you continue until we figure out how to get over this? The digital age does have its drawbacks so far anyway.
Absolutely. I would like to know your opinions about George Bush in particular.
Well, I mean, I think I'm almost you know, gilding the lily if I go there. I mean, I certainly think that he knows who he works for. He's basically the creation of a group of ideologues and people within the energy industry and the defense industry who managed to steal two elections. I think he's done more damage to the country and to basically our institutions, and I'm surprised I'm even saying this, than Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon combined. And it's amazing to me that there hasn't been more resistance from Congress to what is going on. I'm happy to say that the delegation from my home state in Vermont has been in the leadership. Senator Patrick Leahy is really beginning to, you know, call Alberto Gonzalez and to some extent the administration to account. The problem with impeaching Bush, however, is that then you are left with Dick Cheney. So I guess my slogan would be, indict Cheney, then impeach Bush.
Well, you know, I just got wind of news that apparently George Bush has, in fact, assisted in some way Libby. Apparently, he's not going to do his full sentence.
Oh, is he going to pardon him? Well, that was being rumored, so I wouldn't be surprised if it did occur.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an administration that really has very little respect for the Constitution, and they've made that quite clear. And, you know, some people say that George Bush is a fool. I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think he's smart enough to know who he answers to. I certainly wish that we had presidents that were a little bit more educated and world-wise. But I think that we knew what we got, you know, when we elected George Bush. Unfortunately, when you have such low voter turnout in this country and when you have voting machines that are of questionable reliability, and you have people being disenfranchised in places like Florida and Ohio, this is what you get. Hopefully, we're going to be able to correct that in 2008.
In fact, Bush left intact $250,000 fine for Libby and 2-year probation. Other than that, Libby is a free man.
That's amazing. It's really amazing. I mean, I thought when I was younger, I thought that Richard Nixon was quite the destroyer of democratic institutions. But when you look back at it, he seems absolutely visionary compared to George Bush.
You are absolutely right, and I want to thank you. You said something interesting. You said there was a current publishing committee in 2006 had asked you a question. You responded. You said, don't listen to rumors. You said, don't listen to third parties who will try to distort you. You said, if you want to judge me and what I do, you come talk to me, and that's what we've done, talk to you.
Well, I've appreciated very much having this opportunity, and I think you have a great show, and I wish you all the best as you go forward, and despite all the technical difficulties, I'm glad that you were able to spend this time. I just want to advise people to try to visit our sister stations, visit Pacifica.org or PacificaNetwork.org, take a look at what we have to offer, and we will be providing more and more in the years to come. 58 years and still going strong.
And please keep going strong. Mr. Greg Gouma, National Executive Director of Pacifica Radio Foundation, thank you. On behalf of the People Speak, I'm signing off, Malik Johnson, and thank you, Mr. Gouma.
Thank you.
It's been a treat.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the table, by the relief of the summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine, land from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.